Hello, and welcome to episode 31 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Treffler. This week on the show, I am joined by Lisa Corbett, a mixed second and third grade teacher in Ontario, Canada. Lisa and I met through the inquiry-based learning panel that Sarah Ann Lalonde hosted, as you've probably heard about from other episodes of this show previously. Like all the members of that panel that weren't me, Lisa had a lot to add to that discussion, and I asked her to be on the show. Lisa and I talked about inquiry-based learning, not surprisingly, student voice and choice, and we really got into the ways that you can bring those things into your classroom. So, sit back and enjoy episode 31 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Lisa Corbett. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler, and I am joined today by Miss Lisa Corbett. Her and I were on a panel interview on Sarah Ann Lalonde's podcast, Que Sera Sera, talking about inquiry-based learning. And that whole panel was just awesome. Everybody had amazing things to share. I kind of was on the panel as someone wanting to learn about inquiry-based learning, not as someone that knew anything about it. And so I got to ask a lot of questions, and Lisa had a lot of answers. And as I listened to her talk, I was like, that's someone I need on my show. So I reached out to Lisa, and she was gracious enough to meet with me, even when I rescheduled her interview on her twice, I think, because I'm not a professional at all. And tonight I am lucky enough to be joined by Lisa Corbett. If you could say hello, how's it going?
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well, going well. Could you tell my audience a little bit about you, who you are, what you're up to?
So I am a teacher. I've been teaching for 18 years, which is a pretty long time. I live in Northern Ontario, and I've mostly taught primary grade kids. So my experiences with the younger kids. I am a mom as well. I have a 6-year-old and a 5-year-old, and they're thankfully asleep right now.
I have a 5-year-old as well, so I get that struggle very much.
Especially the week before Christmas, right?
Yeah. Actually, tonight he's with his mom, and we have with him and I. We have Santa coming tomorrow because of the custody schedule and everything, and she was like, can I have Zach call you? I was like, sure. So he calls me because he wants to add something to his Christmas list. And he's concerned because I've told him that Santa is coming tomorrow night, that if he doesn't tell me right now, I'm not going to have time to tell Santa.
Like, right.
Okay. Well,
but
sure,
technically,
buddy.
Technically, you've already run out of time to tell Santa, technically.
Yeah, but I felt like that was a hard discussion to explain to a 5-year-old over the phone.
Right.
So instead, right? I ran to Walmart.
Oh, good idea. Good idea.
So he's getting a variation on what he wanted because that's what Walmart had available a few days before Christmas.
Well, that's good. Hopefully he's already forgotten he asked for it, right?
You know, I would hope that, but I feel like this is a recurring thing right now. And that's why she's like, you need to talk to him. You need to let him tell you this. We'll see. We'll find out in a couple days recording this, not from when my audience... At this point, for my audience, it's January, and this is a really stupid conversation, but I don't care. Whatever. It's my show. Deal with it.
That's all right.
You mentioned before we recorded that of the voice ed people, you're kind of the abnormal voice as a quote, regular classroom teacher. But I think that's really critical that we have that variety of voices. So I appreciate that you're a classroom teacher, and I will never say regular or just a classroom teacher, but I appreciate that you're a classroom teacher who's still doing the daily grind, as it were, in front of kids in a traditional setting. I appreciate that.
Yeah. I think sometimes we hear the voices of a lot of the people who've kind of left the classroom. And even though they're still working with kids and still learning about education, I think sometimes it doesn't take long to forget what it's like to sit in front of 20 kids every day and try to manage it and try to fit in all the things you have to fit in and try to keep your sanity. It's a different job than the people who are not in the classroom anymore.
I agree. Teaching profession is so odd in that there is only one job in the field that is the job. And there's tons of other jobs, but they're nowhere near what they're supporting. Like, I'm supposed, as an instructional coach, I'm supporting my teachers. And while I have a nice hybrid role and I still have kids, it's not the same as a traditional classroom teacher. And it can become easy to forget how hard it is to hold your bladder for 50 minutes consecutively every day.
Yes, exactly. And I think too that, like, the consultants have the advantage of coming in and having kind of the hindsight, and they can have the whole classroom view of what's happening, and they can see all the little things that the classroom teacher might miss because she's also trying to focus on the lesson and stay focused on the goal, you know? And I don't know. It's just a different job when you're not in charge of the group.
It is. It's very different. And, you know, I think that's what I've pushed for regularly, and I do have a hybrid role. I technically have a full 7-period course load, but I'm also an instructional coach. So I love the hybrid role I have. I love the being able to do both. And I've actually been in talks with a school or two about possibly moving next year, and I've told them every time, okay, but how do I have kids in front of me? Because whatever you want me to do, I'm willing to do, so long as I still have kids in front of me. Because I think that hybrid role is absolutely critical.
Yeah, I agree with that for sure.
So I think you're right. It's important we stay in front of kids and we're reminded. So,
right.
All right, cool. Well, I appreciate that of you. And I think it's really impressive that you are getting your voice out there as a classroom teacher, because there's a lot to balance every second of every day when you're still in the classroom and you're still getting involved in panels and on social media and in Voiced Radio. So I really appreciate that part of it as well.
Mm-hmm. For a long time, I worked in really small rural schools where I had a split grade 3-4 class, and I was the only grade 3 teacher and the only grade 4 teacher in the whole school. So I really had nobody to kind of collaborate with that was teaching the same thing that I was teaching. And so I started reaching out to people online and building my professional learning network that way. And I, even though now I'm in a school where there are lots of grade 2 teachers and lots of grade 3 teachers, I still really value those outside opinions and those outside ideas. And so I think I'll always continue to do that.
Yeah, I think it's easy for those of us that are in bigger schools and bigger districts. I mean, from my teaching perspective, I'm at a high school that is over 2,800 kids, and that's actually small. We were 4,000 last year. So, you know, it's really easy to forget that there are places where if you want to collaborate, it requires you reach out.
Yeah. Yes. Just to contrast that, I taught at 2 separate schools that didn't even have 100 kids in them. Wow. From kindergarten to grade 8. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. Yeah. Yeah. I started my teaching career in New Jersey, and I taught at a school that was just grade 5 and grade 6, 1,000 kids. And when I tell people that here, they're just sort of flabbergasted by that, because Canadians just don't do school like that. They like small schools, and to have 1,000 kids in a school is just beyond them. They just think that's crazy. So, so to hear that you had 4,000, I just can't even imagine that.
Yeah. When I started doing stuff for the Voice Ed, and they were like, yeah, I work in a pretty big board. There's about 3,000 kids in our board. Oh. And I'm like, that's cute.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's not how we do things here. That's for sure.
No.
I definitely think their way is better. Coming from a massive district, I feel like their way is probably better.
Mm-hmm. Why?
It's impossible to move. I often equate it to steering the Titanic. You know,
right.
It doesn't matter once you see the iceberg, because it's too late. Like,
right.
By the time you've seen the problem, you're past the point where you can correct.
Right.
And so I think having the smaller size would make things a lot easier. You know, even at the school level, to manage as an instructional coach, 150 teachers, 200 last year, I can't one-on-one meet with every teacher every week, let alone every day or every planning period or whatever. You know, there's no way.
Yeah, there would be no way. There'd be no way to do that at all.
So you end up having to prioritize who you can support and how you can support each one of them. Mm-hmm. And then that's a whole new level of problem is what is that prioritization strategy? So I think if you deal with a much smaller environment, you can have a more personal touch. I think we know this from a classroom setting. Certainly smaller classrooms to some extent are better for teachers to be able to support students in a more one-on-one differentiated structure.
Yes, I would agree with that. We got a new principal about a year ago at our school, almost exactly a year ago, and she already knows our school at least by sight, if not by name. And I think that's a really valuable thing for her to be able to do, to be able to walk up to a kid and say hello and know whose class they are in and be able to probably call them by name. That's pretty good. In a school of even a school of 1,000, you could never do that.
Agreed. I'm lucky if I stand in the courtyard at my school and I recognize like 3/4 of the kids' faces. Like I feel like I've seen your face before. A new kid could walk in our campus and I would, you know, half the staff wouldn't notice because, right. I mean, classroom teachers, of course, would notice that, hey, you don't belong here. But right. In terms of administration and people monitoring the students in the transition periods, you wouldn't notice.
Right.
So it definitely is a different beast.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we're definitely coming from some different places, and I think that's great. I think that's going to lead to some great discussion. I'm excited.
Yeah, me too.
Very cool. Well, I'm going to jump right into my first real question for you. And my first question is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Yeah, I've thought about this question because you sent me that before. And sometimes I think the biggest problem is we look around for the biggest problem all the time. You know what I mean? Like, I would rather talk about what's the best thing that's going on in education right now. You know, what's the stuff that's changed in the last, 18 years that I've been teaching I'm so glad it's changed. I'm so glad it's there.
Well, then I'm going to ask that. What is the best thing that's changed? Right. Let's go with that. Why not?
So we met talking on that inquiry panel. Right. And I really, about 4 years ago, when I first started to kind of hear about this and think about how to incorporate it into my classroom, I thought it was going to be really hard. And now I find out that it's actually pretty easy to slip it all in and still cover all the curriculum that I'm required to cover. And so I'm really excited about that opportunity for kids to have their own ideas about what they want to learn and what they want to talk about and what direction they want to go for their learning. And so I think that's a really exciting thing, that it's getting farther and farther away from the textbook and from this list of questions that you have to be able to answer and the checklist of things you've covered. And we're getting closer and closer to kind of, I almost want to call it like a Montessori method, but, that kind of, we don't really do private school here, but, you know, how at fancy private school where parents are paying a lot of money for tuition, that's what they're paying for, is a school that allows their kids to pursue their passions and to figure out what their passions are and do the things that interest them. I think it's really exciting that that's showing up in public school now, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I think there are certainly parts of the Montessori private method that can work their way into public education. Certainly, you know, there's a reason people are paying all that money for it. And while in a lot of cases it's symbol and name, it is also because they have the freedom to do those things. So bringing those to public education can, I assume, be good for us. You know, you said something interesting. You said inquiry-based learning was actually a lot easier than you thought it was going to be to slip in. And I feel like anytime I talk about that, the immediate complaint from teachers is time. We have scope and sequence. We have, you know, course sequence. We have whatever progressions to worry about. How do you find that it is easier than you thought? Can you expand on that a little more?
In the beginning, it felt like something extra that I needed to add in to my already very busy, packed lesson plans. And I found out pretty quickly that actually, if I could start with the interesting provocation, I could start with the interesting question. A lot of the things that I was supposed to cover would kind of naturally fall into place. And so I was really covering the things that I needed to cover just in a different way. And so it hasn't become something extra on top of the other things I have to do, but rather a way to get the things I have to do done in a really interesting way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Mm-hmm.
How do you take that leap, right? Like, so I buy in, I get it, I'm 100% on, and I want my teachers to try this out. How do I convince them that I promise this isn't just the next new thing, this isn't just one more thing? What do I get them to sink their teeth into?
Well, now that's a very, very interesting question. So the first year that I think I was really involved in figuring out, we were doing a collaborative inquiry group at my school with a book called Making Thinking Visible. I'm gapping on the names of the authors now, but they're a group of people from Harvard University, and they have these little thinking routines, they call them, where you get kids talking and really delving deep into one of them is called Chalk Talk, and I've used that a lot in my class, where I give them a picture to look at, and then they write down what they see and what they think and what they wonder and what they notice about the picture. And in that, I can give them, one of the things I have to cover for my grade threes is early settlers. And I can give them a picture of a bunch of people standing out on the prairie, and they can come up with all the things they wonder and all the things they connect to from things they've seen on TV and in the movies. And in one lesson, I can, like one class period, I don't want to really call it cover, like I'm covering the curriculum, but it's more like all of a sudden they're interested in learning that instead of me just standing at the top saying, hey, this is the kind of dress a pioneer woman would wear, right? And so I just find that it's a more interesting way to jump in and figure out what I have to cover. And how do you get teachers to jump on board? I mean, you kind of have to get them to delete their teachers pay teachers account and think that that's the way that you're going to through everything. And you have to just start thinking about, I don't know. I think people just have to start thinking about what's a more interesting way to make all of this more applicable to the kids and get them interested in learning about it instead of, I just have to teach it to you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I just want to point out for the listeners, Making Thinking Visible is by Karen Morrison, Mark Church, and Ron Richert.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Not that I knew that. I totally Googled it, but I just thought it would be fair to include their
sure.
names.
Sure. Yeah. You know. It's a great book, and they've got little videos to go along with it that you can find on the internet, but they have these little routines that work from kindergarten all the way up to grade 12. And anyway, that's just how I got started. I think I do more things than that now, but that's kind of how I got started. And
okay. I've been wanting to do some kind of book study. So maybe one that I need to look into. If that's pushed you, then that may be something worth looking into with my staff.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's an enjoyable book for sure. It's not the kind of book you read cover to cover. You can kind of hop around in it. And I like books like that.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool. You know, I've used Chalk Talk before. When kids come to you, I'm assuming, you know, you teach 2-3. So I'm assuming the K and 1 teachers, are they using the same inquiry-based methods, or are they doing their own more lecture-driven or more manipulative-driven? Or does it look the same in the grades leading up to yours?
That's a tricky question for me to answer because I feel like I often don't know what's going on in my colleagues' classrooms, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know they're teaching all day and I know their kids come out knowing stuff, but I don't always know exactly what they're doing. The grade 1 classroom is right next door to my classroom, and definitely that teacher is using some of the same things. And I can build on those when the kids arrive at my door, but primary teaching is so, I just think we're so close to the beginning of their education career in grade two, that there's so many things that they still have to learn how to do and doing it. I think so. But I still feel like I'm teaching it fresh every time.
Okay.
Yeah.
The reason I ask is I've said this before when we talked about inquiry and a lot of these other, you know, inquiry based and design thinking and these things that require the students to do the thinking. By the time they get to me in high school, I feel like they no longer have any inquiry or passion or excitement built into them. I feel like it's been stamped out by the time they get to me. And I'm wondering if you experience that or maybe you don't experience that at your grade level.
Mm. I feel like we were on the other podcast too. That makes me feel so sad to think that kids are, you know, grade 10, grade 11, and they're already just done. How much of that do you think is just teenage angst, you know? Like I'm 14, I have to hate everything.
I think that's part of it. What really started me on that path was the group of students I had in ninth grade. Now, 3 years ago, they're now seniors. They were ninth graders. And my first period class was the best class of students I ever taught that year. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, first year teaching high school, if you get the best class of students you ever taught to start the 7:15 bell, that's pretty lucky.
Yes. But
they were the best class of students I ever taught. They had the most energy and the most excitement, and they were people. They had personalities, and they were individuals, and they would have conversations with me and goof off and push back and forth, and it was just tons of fun, and they were very engaged, and we learned a lot. But at one point I asked them, like, well, why are you guys in school? And they're like, to get a good grade. Every single one of them, to get a good
grade.
Really? And I'm like, that's not even remotely why you're here. That's...
Right.
Shouldn't even be a consideration as to why you're here. I'm like, all right, well, then what are you guys passionate about? Like, we have a fourth quarter, testing's done, let's standardized testing is finished. Let's do something cool. Like, what are you guys passionate about? They're like, I don't know, sleeping, nothing. Food. you mean cooking? Right. No, just like eating, food.
Right.
Well, not quite. So,
yeah,
that's what started that path for me, is these are what I view as the best possible kids, and they couldn't tell me what they were passionate about. They'd be like, what are we going to do when we grow up? And they'd name, like, well, this job makes a lot of money. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the priority we're pointing to right now?
Right. When I went to university, I went to university part-time. I finished it all a little bit of a time. So it took me a while to finish that. And I had signed up for a literature course that was kind of extra to my program. I didn't really have to take it, but I love to read. And so I thought, I've got some time in my schedule. I'm going to sign up for this course. I got there, and the teacher never asked us to read any novels. Like, it's a university course, and we weren't reading any novels the entire semester. Three quarters of the way through, and I said to him, I don't understand why we're just reading short stories the whole time. And he said to me, well, nobody will read a novel. Everybody will just make excuses. And I thought, well, that's terrible, you know, that these are university students, and the professor has already decided none of them are going to do any of the reading. They're all just here for the credit that they're going to get. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. Is inquiry the answer? I hope so. I hope it's an answer for some kids. I hope that a lot more teachers will kind of jump on board with the idea that kids could be pursuing the things that they are interested in, and they could find their voice, and they could write about what matters to them, and they could read about what matters to them. But it never fully goes away if we can get everybody excited about it. I hope we can.
Yeah, I think that'd be great. You know,
it is
a struggle, I feel like. And I see it in my own son, and, you know, we talked about that, but I see it in my own son. Like, he's so interested in things. You know, I put an Amazon Echo in his room, and he can talk to it and ask it questions. And going back sometimes and looking at the log of questions he asks, it is kind of making his thinking visible, because it'll show me a question he asked, and it'll show me the answer it gave him, and then it shows the next question he asked. And right. then it shows the next question. Like, it just starts this chain of events that it kind of reminds me of the days of falling down a Wikipedia rabbit hole, where it's like, right. Oh, well, now I want to know what that means. Ooh, I want to see this. And then you right. sort of fall into this hole. And it, I can see that visually in his responses. And it terrifies me that someday he's going to be like my students and not care anymore. And right. that terrifies me as a parent.
Right. I'm thinking right now about those kids that continue to be interested in learning and how they don't really have a peer group sometimes in some schools, you know, mm-hmm. they're the only kid who's interested in doing the science. They're the only kid who wants to learn more about space and when everybody else is trying to give up on it. And about that for my own children as well, that they're, I don't know, someone's going to scare the fun of learning out of them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess all we can do is just encourage it at home, right? Like, just make right. sure that that's constantly happening. But I just worry. I worry a lot about it. It's like, I feel like my students get to me already done in right. 9th, 10th, 11th grade. And that's right. so sad. Right. And I think you're doing the right steps. You're doing what needs to be done to make that not happen.
Mm-hmm. I teach writing with Writer's Workshop. And we have a lot of opportunity to choose what the kids have a lot of opportunity to choose what they want to write, how they want to write it, how they want to go about completing their writing learning. And I love that because they come to me with ideas for what they want to do this year. They're very much into making their own YouTube videos. And so it's turned into this whole thing of script writing and researching and trying to make a really good video for themselves. And I love that flexibility, but. And I think I'm in a really good school right now where they're going to continue to have some of that personal space to explore what interests them. But I have at times worked with people. My students were going to finish with me. They were going to head across the hall and they were going to be given a boring daily writing prompt every day for grade 5, every day for grade 6. And by the time they left there, they were going to hate writing again. So, I don't know. In some respects, I guess we just have to get our whole school kind of thinking the same way. How do we keep them all interested? And nobody can break the chain.
Yeah. And that's a hard thing to pull off, right? Like even as an administrator, as a principal, that's hard to pull off in so yeah. many cases.
Right. Well, I see a lot of, we don't really have this here. This is not a concern that I think I would have in any school in Ontario, but I see a lot of American teachers talking about, this is the unit I have to teach. This is the textbook I have to use. Mm-hmm. This is the method I have to use. And they've got someone in administration, I think really well-meaning, who sees a really good way of getting everybody to do it, but they're making their teachers do it, you know, and I don't think you get the best work out of that either.
Agreed. Absolutely. Cool. Well, you know, that actually kind of leads into my next question pretty thoroughly, which you may have already touched on a little bit, but that's fine. Mm-hmm. What is something that you're doing you wish all other teachers would do?
Well, I don't want to turn the whole thing into inquiry, but I really like student-led learning, and I wish that more teachers felt brave enough to do that. We've been studying in my class a Canadian artist named Norm. He's a native painter who paints in a certain style, which then went on to inspire lots of other people to paint in this style. And we've been trying to, you know, do work in this style as well. And every single child's work has come out looking very different from each other. And I wish that more people sort of work with primary kids, that their art didn't have to be a recipe that every kid was following so that every kid came up with a product that looked the same, or in writing that every kid is going to end with a project that finishes all on the same day and is all going to have the same steps and is all going to look the same way. And I just wish people were a little more flexible. I wish they were a little more relaxed about having kids do different things at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that differentiated approach we know is tremendously powerful, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And it is tricky to kind of, it is a juggling act to have different things going on at the same time, but I don't know. You can make it happen.
It can be done.
It can be done.
How do you balance that personally without spending exorbitant amounts of hours building multiple tasks?
Because I let the kids build their own task, I think that's part of the answer to that. I don't feel like I have to have a defined set of success criteria, a defined rubric task that might possibly come up that I can, and maybe I would feel differently if I were teaching older students. But I don't know, at the beginning of a person's education career, if we can just meet you where you are and get going, then we're doing okay. Now I feel less flexible about that in math. I do feel like I need to have everybody kind of in the same place in order for us to do our math lessons. But I don't know, especially writing and reading, everybody's kind of doing their own thing. And I like that.
I appreciate that. I like that you're realistic in there are limitations to it, right? I feel like sometimes people say, oh, differentiation is everything. You have to differentiate all things. And that's not real. Like, that's not reality. Sometimes we have standards. We have every kid needs to get to this point. I can't. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's great that you recognize sort of the limitations of your own approach. It's a very reflective, honest perspective you're coming from.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, we do have to write a report card, right? And I teach grade 3, which is a testing year here in Ontario. And so I do have to make sure that they're prepared for that test. Not that I spend a great deal of time focusing on that, but I still want to make sure that I have given them a fair shot and I've covered every single thing that could possibly show up for them as well as we can. And I guess maybe that's the thing that keeps me on track instead of wandering wildly off into the forest as sometimes I think I want to do. But I don't know. You have to have a focus for sure, but I just have, I guess maybe that's part of what teaching split grades has done for me, because I can never just say everybody's going to be in one place at one time. Because this year I have kids in my class who are 3 years apart in age almost, because my youngest grade 2 and my oldest grade 3, that's a pretty big span of time for them. And so I have to differentiate their learning. They're in completely different learning spaces in their own minds.
You know, I want to talk a little more about that. We talked about it a little bit before we started recording, but how does that work, teaching split, in terms of what do your class sizes look like? How many do you have of each? Is it even? How do you do lessons when kids are that far apart? Mm-hmm. You know, how does that work?
So I would probably have a different answer for some of those questions every year. It just depends on the makeup of the class. In our primary grades, we do have a cap on the number of kids that can be in the class. And I think it's 22 for primary grades. So this, and the rest of them are grade 2s. Last year, I had an exact even split. I had 10 grade 3s. I had 10 grade 2s. I had 10 boys. I had 10 girls. But that's the only time that has ever happened for me. That's why I started doing writer's workshop instead of set lessons, because I had to differentiate their writing so much. I had to differentiate their reading so much. In math, this is the first year for me that I've had to have two complete math programs going on at the same time. I've always been able to. Our curriculum is written, I think, with this in mind, because so many classes in Ontario are split grades. So the curriculum kind of weaves together very nicely. But this is the first year that my grade 2s were really seriously beginning grade 2s, where my grade 3s were like pretty solid grade 3s. And so I have had to do separate math for them. It's tricky. For sure, it's tricky. You have to be able to really balance. somebody being active and being busy while somebody else is on the carpet having a lesson, and how do I get up and how do I monitor all of that? It's tricky for sure, but I don't know. I don't know. I just do.
Yeah. Sometimes it's better just not to ask how, right?
Exactly. Not to think too seriously about it and just do it. Yeah.
So is this a program in terms of being the split 2-3? Is that something that is it targeted to specific students? Because it's not the only option at your school, right? Like there's students that are just in a grade 3 class and students that are just in a grade 2 class. How do they end up with you?
It's all about the numbers. It's all about getting the right number of kids in every class. Are funded by provincial funding, where in the U.S. it's more local funding for every school. So we have people from the Ministry of Education who are telling us this is the number of people that will be in Lisa's class this year. And then we try to look at a lot of different things. We try not to make it, oh, all the weaker grade threes are going to be mixed with grade twos and all the stronger grade threes are going to go with the way grade fours, because that's not really a fair way to do it either. We try to mix it up so that you're mixing personalities up into the right classes and you're mixing kids into, you know, thinking about who might have taught kids before. I don't know. Sometimes it's just sort of random that people are assigned to certain classes. It just kind of happens. In my school, in my particular school this year, we have a straight grade one, we have a split 2-3, and we have a split 3-4. And so we just had to look at the numbers and where did it all even out so that everybody wasn't over capacity in their classes.
Interesting.
I guess every school probably has a different way of deciding who would go where. I have taught, like I said before, at rural schools where there was no other choice. I was the only grade three teacher. You were coming to my class. That was your only option.
And how do parents respond to this? Like, do parents prefer the split? Do they prefer standard? Like, what does that look like for you?
So I grew up in the U.S. I started my teaching career in the U.S. And the first time I came here, I thought it was the craziest thing I had ever heard of, that people would have two grades in one class. I really didn't know how I was ever going to make that work. It's just sort of accepted as a matter of course here. Nobody really kind of questions it. I don't know. Every now and then you might get a teacher a parent who's saying, no, I wanted my kid in this class instead. I feel like he'll be pushed further if he's in the split with the older kids and that sort of thing. But for the most part, the way it is.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. My own daughter is in a straight grade one this year. She started out, and as we thought the class was going to be a grade 1-2 split. And I feel the same about it as a grade 1 as I would as a grade 1-2 split. I don't know. It's just the way we do it here.
Good to know. Well, I think that's great. I'm all about trying new things. So if that's something that is different than what we're doing, we're doing sure isn't working. So sure, let's try it. Let's see what happens.
Right. Yeah, why not, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I want to move into my third question for you. And my third question is, who is the greatest teacher you ever had?
The greatest teacher I ever had. I feel like I was very lucky. I had great teachers all along. I can probably name a great teacher at several different points in my life. My greatest teacher I ever had, somebody that sticks out for me. I took a philosophy class when I was going to community college, Burlington County Community College, when I was living in New Jersey. And the professor in that course, he changed my thinking in so many different ways, really got me starting to think about the fact that there was a different point of view to every single issue. And that point of view has to be considered every time. You cannot just think about your own thinking. You have to think about other people's thinking too, in order to really understand. So he's the one that sticks out in my mind.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that you're coming from a place of point of view, where what you tag in on is point of view, where you say, mm-hmm. you know, everyone has their own point of view and it needs to be considered. All items have different points of view. And that mm-hmm. kind of directs itself right back into this differentiated, student-driven, inquiry-based that you're doing so much of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right, it does.
So often, yeah, those,
I'm going to have to think more about
across.
That.
it's always exciting to me how these connections can be formed between those three questions.
Yeah. There's a really great picture book called Voices in the Park. Anthony Brown, I think, is the author and illustrator of that. And it's four different stories within one book about four different people that go to the park on the same day. And so in the background of each picture, you can see the other character from, you know, the previous story or from the next story you're going to read. And I love to read that book to my classes because I think it gets them thinking about that idea that you see things from your point of view. Someone else is seeing them from a completely different point of view. It was the exact same experience, but it's different for everybody that was involved. Hmm. Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, that considering that is so critical for our students and for us as building our lessons. And I mean, across the board, that's just an important life skill. And I think you're right that we need to bring that into our rooms and teach it to our students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. This is one of the things I think I've learned from Twitter is that you get into you get into this little bubble where you think everybody believes what I believe, you know, everybody thinks the same thing I think. And it's good to have those reminders that not everybody actually does.
Yeah. Twitter is good for that filter bubble of all teachers want to change everything.
Exactly. Everybody believes cell phones shouldn't be in, right? that's the thread that I'm seeing all this week is how cell phones don't belong in classes. And I think, not what I think. And so I don't know.
Yeah.
I started to think, well, maybe everybody does think that. Maybe I'm wrong. And I had to step back and say, well, no, I'm not wrong yet.
Yeah, it can't be that filter bubble, but I think you're right. If you mm-hmm. look at that as just one more point of view and not believe that everybody feels that way, I think is critical. And that's something that's come up on my show before where people will say like, well, we all know this. And I'm like, okay, you and I know this.
Right.
Do we all know that?
Right. Right.
Wow. Mm. Well, Lisa, you got me a lot to think about here. I got a lot to look at, so I appreciate that. I really do.
Yeah.
You know, I want to say absolutely thank you for joining me tonight. I appreciate you coming on the show, and I appreciate all the input you gave on the panel we were on together. It was awesome on both accounts, so I appreciate that.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's good to have to verbalize your thoughts, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That's why I podcast. So if you could, for my audience, a little bit about who you, where can they get a hold of you? Where are you at? And how can they reach out to you if they want to know more about inquiry-based learning and how you do it?
So you can always find me on Twitter, at LisaCorbett0261, is my Twitter handle. And, I welcome anybody to reach out and have a chat.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you again, Lisa, for joining me on the podcast. It was a great chat. I really enjoyed it. If you want to connect with Lisa, she's on Twitter, at LisaCorbett0261. You can also check her blog out by clicking on the link in the show notes. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter. I'm at Brad Schreffler. I love to hear from you guys there, and it's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. I'm booking out for the next couple of weeks to start building up guests to view going into January and February of this year. And until next week, remember that you might be wrong, but you also might just not be wrong yet. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, Your voice is right here.